This episode of Hacks and Flacks was recorded on the 21st of October 2022, when Rishi Sunak was tipped to take over as British Prime Minister. Channel 4 newsreader Krishan Gurumurthy was suspended after being heard on a live stream using an expletive, and rapper Kanye West loses millions in sponsorship deals following a stream of anti-Semitic tweets.
Hello and welcome to Hacks and Flacks with me, Petri Hoskin. Hacks and Flacks is the only series where you'll get the inside scoop on how journalist hacks and the flacks of government and business work behind the scenes to decide which stories you'll be reading with your morning coffee, and perhaps more importantly, how they keep certain headlines off the front pages. What happens if a public figure is a subject of a salacious story? When does a scandal make or break a career? And how do you really know what is or isn't fake news? All these subjects and a whole lot more will be explored by me and a regular panel of hacks and flacks, ready to spill the beans and tell us how the sausages get made. Flacks like former government advisers Giles Kenningham.
Hello.
And Andrew McDougall.
Hello.
Plus hacks like Mick Booker.
Hello.
So now all the gang's here, let's delve into the world of hacks and flacks. Hello and welcome to Hacks and Flacks. I'm Petri Hoskin, or at least I say I am, and you'll just have to trust me. Joining me in the studio are two guys who claim to be regular panellists, Mick Booker and Andrew McDougall. Or is what I've just told you fake news? Because there's enough people out there making, distributing and reading it. But who are they and how are they doing it? It's time to find out. Let's start with you, Mick, being the seasoned journalist you are. Can you always spot a fake news story?
You'd like to think so, but there's different levels of fake news, isn't there? For most people, fake news became something when Donald Trump said whatever he was accused of was fake news, wasn't it? And then it exploded. Everything was fake news, and it was simply to sow distrust in journalists who were pointing out that he may not be the ideal man to run the entire world. So I think that's where that came. But, you know, I think there's always been whatever, you know, fake news or lies getting in the media or untruths. Is it fake news if, say, a PR man for the government says, oh, here's a story, we're going to spend £10 million on, you know, loads of new nurses? If that doesn't happen, is that a lie? Is it fake news? Or is it just something that was true at the time? So I think there's various levels. And then you go to the Alex Jones levels of conspiracies and fake news and talking about how kids slaughtered in a school didn't actually happen and things like that. And then that's an entire distortion that's been put out by a guy whose entire way of making money is built on creating fake news and getting people to watch him and monetize his platforms and keep him going. So there is lots of different levels of fake news, but I would like to think I could spot them because, you know, as someone who works for GB News, the editorial director, we're Ofcom regulated. If we start putting things that is fake news, we can be shut down. As a newspaper editor, if you do it, you can get fines. You know, you've got to do full page apologies. Or again, you could create a Twitter storm that gets you shut down. So yes, I'd like to think I could spot them, and that's what they pay me for.
Andrew, it's got to be possibly one of the most damaging things in history that Donald Trump coined this phrase, fake news, because it really has sowed this absolute distrust in anything media, anything you do, anything Mick does, anything I do.
Yeah, and I think this is, again, when you have a system like politics and the media, in the second somebody comes in that operates without shame or that regard for the truth, then you're really in trouble. Somebody who has the matches in their hand to run around and light things on fire, that's absolutely dangerous. Just to pick up on some of that, I think Mick hit the nail on the head there, is the Alex Jones. Like, if you think about fake news, Pope endorses Trump, that kind of thing. The test for me should always be, is it too good to be true? Like anything in life, if it sounds too good to be true, then it probably is, and you probably need to interrogate that. And then there's some stuff you can do about, well, who put that claim out? What's their background? Do they have an editor? Do they have editorial policy? Do they have reputable journalists? Do they have a following on social media? There's things you can do to quantify information. It'd be nice if the tech companies would help you kind of do that, and we'll come to that. It's become a money spinner. So if you're, you know, teenagers in the basement in Romania is the classic example, you know you can torque up near-ish enough to the truth news, or take a published news story, give it a bit of extra zip, and watch that light on fire around the internet because the algorithms prioritize the sensational. It's become a money spinner for people who aren't involved in journalism or PR. So I think that's where a lot of the confusion has come with. So I don't think, like, it's not an extension of spin, although to Mick's point, it's like, yes, as a government advisor, did I brief out stories that were true at the time that then got kiboshed for different reasons? Yes. But then you have to manage that relationship with the press and never knowingly steer them down that route. Because the second I lie to someone like Mick, I'm dead in the water. Yeah. I'm of no use to anyone. So it's not in my interest to do that. It's sometimes in my interest to put out my preferred version of what's gone on. The confusion over Suella Braverman and why did she resign? Was it the information or was it a row about immigration? One side will put out, well, she mishandled classified information. The other side will put out, well, no, they didn't agree on migration targets. And both can be true. And so I think seasoned journalists get that they're getting one side of the story, and it's their job to interrogate the other side.
See, I kind of brushed it off around the Trump time. I was getting seasoned, long in the tooth, whatever you want to call me, old. But I just remember then it suddenly started having an effect on people in my family. So my son was getting to around about 14, 15. For some reason, we're talking about Hillary Clinton in our house, and he started repeating things that Donald Trump had said about her. And I thought, well, that's a bit weird. No, that's not true. I'd say to him, no, it is true. He said it, and I've seen it on this website. I've seen it on this other website. And then I thought, this is having an effect on people, and this is dangerous. And then the next time I saw it in my family was my dad, who, normal, sensible fella, but he'd got a terminal illness, so he was just about bedbound, and he had an iPad, and he spent his time looking around the internet on an iPad. Mm-hmm. And then he started asking me things about how are we going to get nuked from North Korea and things like that. And he's a sensible, normal bloke, and he started asking me all these weird questions from stuff he'd read on the internet, just browsing around, because he doesn't know which site. He's from a generation where if it says it's a news site, then it's like a news site. It's like a newspaper. It's reputable. I'll take that as read, that the people behind it are doing it for the right reasons and they're trained journalists. And because he didn't really know, and he was so trusting, he said to me, is this true? Is this true? Is this going to happen? Oh, we're going to get new. And it was, I thought, how fascinating that it has gone that far and people are believing it. And it's up to people like us in, you know, reputable places like GB News and you in your position, you know, high-flying PR man, to only speak the truth. But, you know, we have a huge responsibility. And it, when I'd seen it happening in real time in my life, I thought, wow, I've got to take this seriously.
And Andrew, to that point, there were rumours, of course, that Russia, with its fake news, was bending the elections in America, and even as far as bending people's thoughts over Brexit in this country to disrupt, to cause problems. How do we survive that? How do we move beyond that level of infection, if you like?
That's the question of the age in many ways, because to pick up on Mick's point, to have a news site in the past, I mean, we touched on this before on this podcast, you used to have to put a lot of money behind something. You had to have a TV station. You had to invest in all the broadcasting technology, the talent. If you ran a newspaper, you'd had to have the printing presses and all of the editorial guidelines. But now a URL looks like a URL. And if I see something online, it can look as good as somebody else's URL. So there's no easy heuristic for people who aren't informed about their information diet to make that distinction between what's real and what might be fake. So we have to find a way around that. And to your point, Petri, yes, bad people will do bad things to our open information systems. And if you think about the history of Russia, for example, the KGB would try 1,000 different ways to seed stories like that, and that the classic one about AIDS. They got that out through an Indian news outlet that then beamed itself back into North America. But now we have the hothouse of social media where they don't even have to try. They can post whatever they like, whenever they like.
And they've got roomfuls of people doing it.
That is their job. The Internet Research Agency, that is their job. And every government, it's no secret, will have a team that is meant to do that. Because what, you know, enemies of the West love to do is use the West's openness against it. And one of the things that makes us what we are is the Fourth Estate and the press and the people that would interrogate that. And to Mick's dad, you know, he used to be able, when he read that newspaper, knew that there was a reporter that had an editor that would fact check. And now, you know, because of the trouble in the media industry, you've gutted a lot of that back end function, and you're making fewer reporters do more And so the quality of work, I think, is dropping anyway. And so that's kind of this perfect storm to your point, but how do we fix it? We have to fix from all angles. Mm. It involves the tech companies.
Yeah.
They have to find a way to not upweight the sensational. And if I have information that I can show you is produced by a professional team with an editorial policy, Google should weight that higher than Romanian teenager with his content factory. But that's not how they prioritize. They prioritize on what gets clicks, what sells ads, what makes money, not what's true. And until we get that balance right and start prioritizing what is true, we'll be lost in this swamp where Mick's poor dad can kind of come to the dinner table and go, all this crazy stuff is happening, and sort me out, tell me what's
wrong. But this idea as well, that in my mind now that there is all these fake news factories that the Russians, the Chinese and everything are pouring out, then leads to the fact that people don't believe what anyone says
that's
anymore.
True. Yeah,
that's the problem. And even sensible people like us are now questioning everything they see, particularly on something
TikTok,
like that. And again, it's the natural thing that journalists should question everything, but now it's like, that's just not true at all.
Yeah.
And that's dangerous as well when, you know,
especially the volume of information we're all seeing every day now. You know, Malcolm Gladwell writes about, we can't be naturally skeptical about everything everybody tells us because we drive ourselves nuts and we'd be exhausted. I have to know that if somebody in my position speaks to somebody in Mick's position and I tell you something, you have to at least know that at a baseline, I would not sell you down like a completely fake, because that just wouldn't work for us and I would be found out. And just the mental exhaustion you get from having to question every single thing you're told.
Well, I remember,
make us all frustrated and want to give up.
Yeah, I went on air when it was front page of the Telegraph, had the story that Liz Truss wanted localised pay deals.
Yeah.
And I went on air and I said, right, there's this story. Is this a good idea or a bad idea? The first hurdle I had to cross was people phoning me saying it's not true. How can that be true? It's so stupid. Why would she do that? It's not true. It's not true. And I was saying, but it is true. I've checked it. I've got it from another source. I think the Indie had it as well. And I trust these papers, right? So I trust that it's true. And then, of course, the next day she went back on it. Mm. And I really had to go on air and go, see, people don't believe the stories that I give in a world where I should be trusted.
Yeah.
Or even worse, because the politician had to reverse themselves.
Yeah.
They think that you were wrong when you were right at the time. And so much of what we do,
exactly.
Nick, you'll know that the story is right until the moment it's not right. And I can remember one time when Canada was trying to enter the Trans-Pacific Partnership, it was called at the time, and we were almost in, but not quite in. And somebody said, I'm going to write that we're in. I said, well, that's not right now, but I'll tell you when it's right.
Mm.
And then it ended up being right, but somebody else moved the story. And then they accuse you of kind of, but it's like, there are 38 moving parts here and many different nations. And I was just trying to give you what was right at the time. And I would never want you to be wrong, because that doesn't help you. It doesn't help me. But you do get caught out by these things. And the average person has never had to think about this. They just think that you had it wrong all the way.
Yeah.
They didn't miss the twist and turn, but you were right at the time and then wrong later.
It's interesting.
But you confirmed that it was wrong later. So that's your job.
When we were, when I first started as a tabloid journalist, and there used to be an award ceremony, but it used to be called the Shafters. And it was the Showbiz Awards for all the crazy showbiz stories that had made it over the last year. And you got there was special awards for the most ludicrous ones. But these were all ones that were printed in newspapers. And these were ones during the heyday of tabloid, was it Freddie Starr ate my hamster, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Which again was a PR stunt.
Yeah.
But it was on the front page of a national newspaper and we all laughed at it. And it was, ha-ha, that's really funny. It helped Freddie Starr, bizarrely. Yeah. It helped whoever it was the subject of it as well. They got their moment of fame.
Help the hamster, then.
Didn't help the hamster, which may or may not have existed anyway. But that was back when fake news, as it was, and I'm doing my air parentheses there for people listening, was a bit of fun.
Yeah.
So there was a time in the tabloid press where, with a nod and a wink, it's sort of true. And I remember everyone who used to go up and get an award at the Shafters was Well, it was true at the time.
Yeah.
When it was printed, it was true. Just 20 minutes later, not so true. So it was. It seemed to be a tabloid staple. And when I first was an agency reporter, there was some rivals. They used to stunt up certain stories towards the lighter end of the market. It would just be a page lead somewhere in one of the red tops. That a story that was virtually made up, shall we say. It had a grain of truth in it. Mm. People had played along with it, and it ended up as 300 words with a nice picture in there. And that ended up in some newspapers, and you could see that they were making money out of it. So obviously we never went down that route ourselves, but you could see that there was a market for it. It wasn't, oh, this is terrible fake news. It was, and we didn't have the internet then, so it didn't go around the world, so no one could check it. No one could shut you down straight away.
That opened the door, do you think, to bigger fake news stories?
I think it shows you what humans are like, in that we like making things up, and we like to have a bit of fun at other people's expense. And I think,
but what is storytelling other than, well, there exactly, is the real world storytelling. Yeah. And, you know, like the North American equivalent, you'd have the National Enquirer.
Yeah,
that was by the till at the supermarket. Yeah. And it was all about alien abductions.
Well, right.
Everybody knew when you reached for that. It was, you know, but that it was a bit of fun.
But was
everybody,
a comic.
But that was the cultural understanding. Yeah. Now, and that was specific to a culture, like the red tops are specific to Britain. But now that we're in a global information economy, nobody's in on each other's kind of inside or information consumption. So that's a bit of the confusion.
The Sunday Sport was launched a few years in. It was what the London bomber found on the moon.
That was my favourite. Yeah. It was my favourite newspaper.
And we all laughed along.
Yeah, there was one with a bus parked on the moon.
And I'm sure it was there. I mean, unfortunately, none of us could get up there to check, so it may be true.
Is that the thing, though, with fake news, is that there is some form of deniability, that there's some form of, you know, if you keep saying it's fake long enough, then people start to believe it's fake. And I'm going to point to Donald Trump because he is the master at this. Who, Andrew, is advising him just to constantly repeat fake news? I mean, look what happened when the FBI or the CIA politely knocked on his door and went in to find papers that he had no business having. He's just told his base that they raided him and it's an infringement. He'd made it all unclassified with a wave of a wand. If you say something loud enough and long enough, can you make it fake?
Well, I think he's a very particular case, because he was the one that directed very much. There's nobody told him to do that. That was just his instinct, and had always been his instinct. If you go back to the 1980s in the New York tabloids in the real estate world, he did that all the time about his relationships, about his deals. He lied about his wealth, about the size of the investment, who was funding, and that was always his MO. But when you're a real estate developer trying to make a few tabloid pages, it's not a big deal if you kind of bend the truth. It's like the story that Mick just told. It's like it's a bit of fun, really.
Yeah.
When you're the leader of the free world, it takes on a different thing. And the difference now is that you have this information economy, again, around the president, that is so fueled by partisanship and, more importantly, negative partisanship. It's not that they want to believe what the president's telling them. It's that they want to hate the other people so much more. So you portray it, he did quite smartly, as an attack on him, attack on us. They're trying to take us down, our movement down. They know I'm a danger to the establishment. The swamp doesn't want me. So they use that as this kind of community building. It's insidious, it's corrosive, but he's smart. He knows that in this environment, he can do that, and there will be a cohort that will follow him, because there are information sources, whether it's maybe not InfoWars, but, you know, some of the other OANN news and all these other ones that exist to perpetuate him. Why? Because he gets the clicks. He gets the money in the information economy. The more you write about Donald Trump, the better off you do. And that's the same for the mainstream press as well. The ratings for CNN, the New York Times subscriptions, Washington Post, all went up because of Trump, because it became about battle, information battle. And every politician now would be dumb not to try to mobilize their audience around what they want to do. And you're left trying to poke holes in it. And now, again, nobody trusts the system. So it's, of course, the media.
And because we are, again, going back to one of your points made before, we are so now connected, aren't we? We're not just someone who lives in a village in the northeast of England who's interested in what happens there. There was a point where you were a Brexit supporter. Anything that Donald Trump did, you were on his side. You were all part of the same movement. And if anyone's having a go at him, he's having a go at us. We're the populists. Don't you dare have a go at us. And so some of them may have turned a blind eye to some of the things that actually were true that he had done, that he's getting away with, because they're just trying to bring us down. They're trying to bring down the establishment, are trying to fight back against us. And now, because we react to these stories in the States as if it's happening next door, And so everyone has got in these little tribes and we're tearing each other apart.
But Mick, how do you manage that in a news environment where you almost take on the nag as a journalist that wants the truth out there by saying, you know, Donald Trump's a liar, he's a crook. And the more you say it, the more you play to his base. So you almost don't say it, so you almost don't get the truth out there. It's a really tricky conundrum.
It's a tricky one. And we, again, when I was on the Express, we had a certain audience to aim at, both newspaper and online, and you play to your audience. But you can't be reckless about it. You do have to have that compass that keeps you on the right line. You can't fall into the same trap. We're regulated as a newspaper. We're regulated
the more you
GB
say
News.
That it isn't fake, the more his believers believe it is fake, because you're part of the mainstream media saying that it's his fake.
But
fake.
You know, at the end of the day, we have to be able to sleep well in our beds at night, and we have to keep to that. You know, we have to do that. But again, it's we're still in a position where we've had all this. He's had everything thrown at him. He still says everything's fake, and he could still be the next president of the United States.
Yeah, he certainly could.
So, you know.
Let's turn to another president, if I can, because again, Andrew, from your point of view, if you were advising your people, Bill Clinton, slam dunk, right? Evidence that
the blue dress
that Monica Lewinsky's mother kept wrapped up, which is a bit weird. But anyway, that was the
president.
Thing. But Bill Clinton's denial was, I did not have sex with that woman, right? Who advised him to say that when clearly fluids were spilt?
Yeah, and you know, it's the yo. But yeah, you know, it's one of those things where you know, you can see the legal minds going there on like, you know,
I
believe sex is well, no, well, look, here's the tricky thing. When you're talking about sexual infidelity, it's nobody's comfort zone. You never want to admit to something, even if you're kind of caught red-handed or blue-dressed or however fluids have been spilled, you know, because that's awkward. It's awkward privately with your spouse. It's awkward when you're the president of the United States, right? Yeah. So you try to get away with, well, like, just because, you know, it was oral sex, that's not full sex for me. That doesn't count. Like, that's, and that might be what he genuinely thinks, right? And then at some point, you're like, why do people even care about this? Because, you know, there's some standard that people's private lives are private lives, and if she's not like a spy or an agent. And then you think about the changing times, the deference of the press and opponents to go after it. JFK did 1,000 times worse than Bill Clinton, or at least the equivalent, you know.
Poor old Marilyn.
With mafia-linked dames. And that's like, but the press just didn't go there at the time, because that was the standard of the time, and there was more of a cozy understanding. So that's eroded as well. And so, you know, what was Bill Clinton thinking? Well, like, this is embarrassing. I don't want to have to answer to any of this. So, like, he was just angry about it.
What would you have advised him? Just to put his hand up and say, I was wrong, rather than try to... The whole I did not have sex with that woman got everybody doing what he didn't want them to do, and that is talking about what he did with that woman.
But I think back on him now, and I think that he's rehabilitated to me. In my mind, he came out of it quite well.
I still want to know why he was on the Epstein planes, but that's another...
that's another conversation. Yeah.
But I think it's also... It depends what your opponents are doing, too. We can't take them out of it. The Republicans went after him. You know, Gingrich, Ken Starr, there was an apparatus, you know, coming after him, which Hillary Clinton famously decried, right? That you can't operate in a vacuum. If your opponents are going to come after you on this, at some point it becomes about fighting them and not about getting the truth. And what I would tell clients all the time is like, if you're going to eat a shit sandwich, you eat it in a day. You don't spread it out over. If you've done something wrong, get it over with as soon as you can, and then it's done.
Yeah.
And then if people want to keep banging on about it, that looks badly on them. If you know, you have to just get it out, as painful as it is, have it out and be done with it. And most people understand that we're all made from crooked timber, and that people, particularly in positions of power, right, you know,
abuse that.
Yeah, you know.
Well, there was the one that sticks out for me in recent years of being on newspapers is when there was Operation Yew Tree, and there was all sorts of names floating around the internet, and then there was all sorts of names of certain men, you know, showbiz men from, you know, the 1960s, 70s, who'd been accused of being just like Jimmy Savile, been the worst types of sexual criminals. And one in particular, where there was a list that floated around the internet, wasn't there, of the people who'd been at a certain boy's home and had abused the boys there. And didn't Philip Schofield sort of try to start showing it to David Cameron on This Morning
there
at
was
one point?
He accidentally revealed the one list of the names to Cameron.
And that list was fake news.
Yeah.
That had gone around the internet. People like Philip Schofield had started to believe it. You know, it was. But again, that was during a time of hysteria, and hysteria helps that, and that's exactly what has happened with Donald Trump. It was internet hysteria, wasn't there? A lot of it that fueled it,
but there was an example in this case that made it true. And if you look at Jimmy Savile, that would have been a fantastic story to most.
It makes it believable, doesn't it?
That Britain's most popular entertainer was for decades a serial abuser of other people. So there is that. And then you get to those lists have always existed of those things.
Yeah.
But then they come into people like Mick's hands, and Mick's job as a journalist is to interrogate that and see, well, let me make some calls. Let me speak to people.
They were interrogated in public.
And, and if something then meets the test for publication, gets lawyered up, then you go with it.
Yeah.
And then you can have a debate. But that's, and I think this is what I worry about, the press now in this mad rush to match the internet.
Mm.
You know, they're forgetting what their value add is. It is applying that judgment, discernment, qualification of information. It's not, you can't out-hit the fake news side of the internet. You will never do it. You have to go for quality and provide people that comfort.
And
that if I read it in this publication, it will have been through a process that gives me confidence that this is right.
Talking for newspapers, and I think after Leveson and that generation of journalists, we became very, very, very careful as to put anything that was committed to the printed page. And we
too cautious?
In some cases, yes, but I think it was just simply to...
The pendulum swings, though, doesn't it?
It does, but the thing with a newspaper is if you've got a few editions, great. If you've only got one or two editions, you can't really change things very much. But on the internet, if something's on the internet and people start saying that's wrong, you can change it very, very quickly and it's never been there, or you can hide it, whereas... In printed newspapers, caution first these days, because you've got to get it right, otherwise they shut you down.
We've all known that press and the relationship with the public, PR and press relationship with the public, has been eroding slowly over many years. But what sped it up was COVID. So the Globe came under pressure and scrutiny with this disease that made us all behave in really strange ways. And whenever people nowadays talk about distrust of people like you, Andrew, and people like you, Mick, it is now within that prism of COVID. Mm. We were lied to. Experts were no longer considered experts. The press could no longer be trusted. They were lying to us. That is a breakneck speed of distrust, post-truth, post-expert. How do we get it back, Mick?
It's going to be a long time, I think, because there is a lot of people who have made an industry off the back of COVID. You know, there's been the stories about vaccines that come out now, about how many people have had heart attacks as a result of the vaccine. And there is a distrust, as you say, of experts, but
of scientists.
But the problem I think we had at that time was there was just so many people who said they were scientists who popped up everywhere. Everyone became an expert. But that, again, that's the nature of the internet, where when anything happens, everyone becomes an expert. So we suddenly, all of us sat at home Googling because we were locked down, all of us suddenly became experts in various aspects of pandemics and vaccines and things, and you know, life expectancy and things like that. But then the moment that Russia invaded Ukraine, we suddenly became experts in warfare as well on the internet as well. And then we all had an opinion on that, and we all knew another expert on that. So that became the conspiracies that came out around that soon fed it. But we'd been conditioned, because we'd all been sat at home looking at our devices during the pandemic, and none of us had known anything like it. None of us had been locked down before. So I think it sent a lot of us a bit crackers, to be honest. And I think that's where a lot of that, the threads of that start with, because we all went a bit nuts, and some more nuts than others.
But the distrust, Andrew, is now so palpable. How do you, as somebody who works in public relations, get that trust back?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's in this case, you'd hopefully be trying to represent people that have something to contribute to this debate, that know what they're talking about. And I think a story like COVID is a hard story for journalists anyway, especially when you come into an issue as complicated as this, when newsrooms are already on their knees, because you probably don't have your medical beat reporters that you would have had. You know, you probably would have had a desk of 10 or 12 people that you could sic on various aspects of the story. Now you're asking a general assignment or a trainee or somebody to become an expert in something. Mm. And even if they go talk to an epidemiologist, people don't understand that nothing's certain in this kind of science, a new virus, a novel virus. There's a lot the experts don't know, and they don't know what's normal, to the vaccine point. Vaccines always have adverse effects. You will never have a vaccine that does not have an adverse effect. If you give millions and tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people a vaccine, there are going to be hundreds, thousands of people that have adverse reactions. And that's normal. That's not bad. Mm. So there's a literacy piece there that doesn't get done because people don't have those sources of news that they trust to get that literacy piece. So it's all these things that are very hard to explain to people at the best of times, to the point of we all think we're experts now. Yeah, there are real experts, but it takes time to query them and understand them. And when your pressure is not the next day's paper, it's what can I get online right away? Corners get cut. Mm. You know, you used to have a whole day to chew on something, get contrary opinion, weigh it up in your mind as a journalist and decide kind of, here's everything I've been told and here's what I think about it. Now everything kind of moves. I get one quote in, well, then I get another quote in, I'll update the story online, and then it kind of trundles over, whether that's war or COVID. And the joy of the internet is it does bring you expertise. I still follow some COVID experts, epidemiologists, Adam Kucharski and other, that gave me really valuable stuff during the pandemic. But there are the charlatans out there, or the contrarians, or the guy that, you know, Joe Rogan interviewed about COVID. There is differing opinion within science. Science is not one fact. It is a process to collect information, and a lot of it is blind alleys. And so that's tough for people to understand. So you're asking a lot of an audience at a time of stress per mix.
Well, that was it. We were all of us scared, even journalists, weren't we? I remember a terrifying day. The worst front page I've ever done, which was, it was actually a good front page, but it always makes me think of those really bad times at the start of March, April, that time of 2020. And the splash that we did was when it was around about Mother's Day, and they said, don't go and see elderly people. Mm-hmm. But the headline was, for your mother's sake, stay at home. We had a picture of the Queen on the front page as well. There was another story that she was going to make, you know, she was going to speak to us to try and soothe us all and bring, you know, a great moment of national portent. Up the top, there was another picture of empty shelves with everyone panic buying. And that front page, for me, doing that, I thought, wow, what a front page. Mm. But I remember there was only about three or four of us at Canary Wharf on that floor because everyone was at home apart from us that day because we were doing we were producing the newspaper. In that moment, I remember how worried I was. So no wonder, you know, someone sat at home who isn't lucky to be as educated as I have, who's looking at stuff on the internet and questioning everything and worrying about
through the prism of fear.
Through the prism of fear as well. Yeah. I think that set us all back a hell of a lot during that time.
We've got a long path, though, haven't we, to get that trust back. Like I said, you can throw an expert on a screen or in front of a newspaper and everyone's going, yeah, that's not true. Or they will come at it from a point of view of it being fake, of it not being true, rather than going, could it be true? Well,
and especially if your political leadership, to pick one example, are the ones heaping scorn on expertise, you know, that we've had enough of the experts, or even Liz Truss going like, you know, the abacus economics. Well, guess what? The market was right.
Yeah.
And all your talk about the market, not the orthodoxy being wrong, well, you're out on your ass. So you tell me who was wrong. And so that's why any official that leans into the Trump view of stuff is really committing a public act of harm. And if you're in a position of power, whether you're an editor, a reporter, or you cannot lean into this because you destroy the system on which our society agreed.
On which freedom is based.
Yeah. And look, nobody wants to live in a world where nobody understands what's true and what's fake, because it is hell. And we're learning that. And I don't think we're learning it quickly enough.
Let me just point to another thing that could be adding to this, Mick. And, you know, GB News does it, Talk does it, LBC does it, BBC does it. In fact, everybody seems to do it. Is that they bring people in on panels to give opinion. And it confuses a lot of people as to what is fact and what's opinion? Mm. You get, you know, you get a journalist, and I've done it. I've done paper reviews. I've done them with you, where we've been asked to come into a news organisation and give our opinion on a story. Now, you and I have been around the block a couple of times, yeah. So we probably held back quite a bit on that. But you don't always see that. So you get journalists who work for companies giving opinions on stories. Is that adding to the confusion of the viewer or the listener or the reader?
I think it can do. I think for our part on GB News, we try and keep the opinion away from the role in news and try to keep our news reporters, news presenters away from
still,
the opinion
presenters.
The audience
presenters. May not nuance.
I understand. I get that. And it's something that we, again, have to be very careful of. We've got Ofcom regulating. So it can be confusing to some people. But I think most people, you rely on their common sense. And yes, we have a huge problem with fake news. That's why there is this episode. But most people have common sense and can tell the difference, most people, but there is a huge amount of people that don't. When I was doing panels and with you and things like that, TV particularly went down that route where they wanted the biggest fight on there, didn't they? Mm-hmm. They wanted the Brexiteer versus the Remainer.
Yeah, they wanted us to disagree, and we really did.
Everyone to scream and shout at everything. But no, again, but that's going back to my background as a journalist. I worked for The Express when we started the Brexit campaign. Now, I voted Remain, but I was always trained as a journalist to be able to walk into anywhere and be a journalist in that building, whoever the audience is, whatever it's for. Yeah. And I've always thought that, whereas now there is a lot of journalists who go to specific organisations and they're more like activists. Mm-hmm. And so they will tell you party line. And then, so I've never seen, I mean, I'm fairly, I haven't got a political party myself. I've never
me
voted Tory in my life and voted Remain. So I just do the job for the audience that I'm supposed to be working for. So therefore, I had no real problem with working for The Express during the Brexit campaign. Or I do remember the night of when Brexit actually happened, and quite a few of us looked around with very raised eyebrows when,
whoops. One of the things in news trying to compete with the internet is news is not a business. It's not a gas. It doesn't expand to fill whatever space you give it, right? You know, there's only a certain amount of news that happens every day. And if I could encourage anyone to read two books, it's Postman's Amusing Ourselves to Death and James Fallows' Breaking the News. Because James Fallows wrote Breaking the News about U.S. 24-hour cable news in the mid-90s. And everything he wrote, it's true. It's come true. It is, you know, and you won't want to hear me say this, Mick, because GB News is a rolling news operation. Mm. TV news should not be on all day. There's not enough news all day. So you fill it with the carnival barkers and the entertainment. You don't fill it with news. And it's very rare that something happens in a day. Like yesterday would be a day. There was genuinely stuff happening all the time that you could do it. But most time, it's just a waste of time. And I want to go back to a world where I get my news in 30 minutes to an hour. It's all there. I can come in one spot, digest it, and that gives my brain a break from this constant rolling.
Norm MacDonald, the old Canadian comedian, said that, you know, back when he was growing up, the news was half an hour every night, and even then they had to do a story about a caribou at the end just to fill it up. So, you know, it's we do fuel it, I think.
You can't help if you're on rolling news because you need to keep people watching.
Yeah.
You know, you need to keep almost an entertainment aspect to the news, and maybe that's again
news
damaging.
Is not
it, yeah, but that
can be entertaining
damaging
sometimes.
The brand for everybody.
Well, I remember it's going back to whether we're governable anymore, actually, and where we are with Liz Truss and the because Boris said if you shut down Twitter, he'd still be there, didn't he? But I remember looking up at a TV when I was on the Daily Star and about when Gordon Brown and that, and when you've talked about that bloody woman.
Oh yes.
And since then, I just feel as though, for me, I just think the churn of news, both online and 24-hour, has never stopped since then. And governments have just found it very, governments in particular, find it very hard to govern because of that constant news cycle that never seems to stop now. And I think it is, we're getting to a point where, you know, there's always a reason to hit the government or whoever's in charge.
But it almost becomes campaigning in the press.
Been.
I mean,
yeah.
People like Sky, when they wanted, it was so obvious they wanted rid of Boris Johnson, whether that was for political reasons or for entertainment reasons. It became a campaign to get rid of Boris Johnson. That's what it felt like to me as a journalist watching.
Well, there was a lot of journalists as well, TV journalists, who whenever they've been tweeting during the last few weeks about Liz Truss, it's they do that little fire emoji next to what something that they're saying, say this is totally shocking. So there's this editorializing that they're doing
absolutely.
As well.
And that's a whole episode about how Twitter has ruined
and
journalism.
Then people don't know whether, so is that the news or is that them, is that really their opinion? And that's that's people who work for proper TV news channels.
And I don't want to know your opinion. You should never want me to know your opinion. Because then I don't trust you when you give me the straight news. And just, to pick up is an important point about government communications. I'll tell you this from the inside. 24-hour rolling news and social media and the internet have made everything tactical. It's very hard to do strategy, to stay on something for a while, because there's always another little fire to put out or a little flare to set off to get people looking the other way. Mm-hmm. And it could be as simple as a tweet. Or a sly briefing, and then suddenly everybody chases that, and then everybody chases this, and
there's no wonder nobody trusts us.
Well, no, and then you add to that the fact that newsrooms are smaller, more stretched, with less quality control on the editorial desk, and is it any wonder we're in this kind of soup of crap?
Can you think of a fake news story that has been your...
Again, back in those days where they were fun, and I know someone got into a newspaper, it was a story about someone who'd won, I think it was... It was a square of turf from, I think it was Wembley or something like that. And he'd won it, and it was his birthday, and his mates had got him, and he'd won, and they'd had a few drinks, and there it was. He was presented with it on a night out. And then the next day he woke up, opened his curtains, and there was a square of turf out of his front garden. And the story being that his mates had sorted that out. Now, I think there'd been a grain of truth in that, which had managed to turn into 350 words in a national newspaper.
I love it. Let's move on then and look at our favourite bit, and that is the PR Cock-Up Award of the Week. And just for those who listen, we are recording this in the week that... Liz Truss resigned. We don't know what else is going to happen by the end of today, but just so that we're aware of that, who would be your big loser this week?
I'm going to go with Cristiano Ronaldo.
Oh.
His team, Manchester United, finally put in a top-class performance against a top-four rival, 1-2-0, and he stole the headlines by storming off the bench with 4 minutes to go. And you can think that's either brilliant PR, because he's forcing his way out, but what a dick move. What a lack of consideration for your teammates that they did this
that's
great thing, and you make your manager talk about what a little shit you are for
thing is, though,
trundling home.
When you're that big and that
just
rich.
Fuck that guy. I hate him anyway. Let's not forget what he's accused of.
I would.
For you, Nick?
Well, Kanye West still seems to be causing himself side problems.
Did the Jews make you say that, Nick? Did the Jews make you say
yay?
That?
Yay? I've heard it, ye or yay.
Yeah. Who the fuck cares? Like, the man's mentally ill. Stop looking at him he's some sort of,
He seems to be bulletproof from it as well, doesn't it? Because we just seem to keep on giving him these platforms all over the world, and he keeps on coming back, and we listen to him, and he apologises, and he goes off, and then he...
Yeah, White
he
Lives Matter. That's just in the last week, isn't it? White Lives Matter, anti-Semitism, and then buying...
He bought Parler as well.
Parler.
Which...
But it's cruel. He is mentally ill, and we're rubbernecking his dysfunction. And it's like, I get he's a public figure, but come on, man.
He does keep throwing himself in front of the bus, though.
Well, yeah, I mean...
What can you do?
Ignore him, It's like, but I guess I shouldn't say that to an editor. Like, that sells papers, right?
Of course it does. Okay, let's wrap up for this episode. We'll be back again with another Hacks and Flacks, and that is 100% true. Hacks and Flacks is presented by me, Petrie Hoskin, produced by Amanda Redman, and brought to you by Trafalgar Strategy. If you want to get in touch with your take on the current news climate, you can do that by emailing us at hackflackpod@gmail.com. And don't forget to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time on Hacks and Flacks.